Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 2, verse 8. I'm going to read two verses, this one and the following one. Dharma sanushtita punsan vishvakshena patasuya nok pareyev yadi rati shrama eva hi kevalam.
Yeah. What is the word?
What's that?
Verse.
What is it? It's, again, Canto 1, Chapter 2, Text 8. Dharma sanushtita pumsam vishvakshena katasuya inopareyem yadiratim shrama evahi kevalam. The occupational activities a man performs according to his own position are only so much useless labor if they do not provoke attraction for the message of the personality of Godhead. The next verse, 1-9, dharmasya hyapavargyasya narto urta yopakopate nartasya dharmaikantasya kamolabhaya hit shmritaha. All occupational engagements are certainly meant for ultimate liberation. They should never be performed for material gain. Furthermore, according to sages, one who is engaged in the ultimate occupational service should never use material gain to cultivate sense gratification. And I'm going to do the next one too. Kamasya nindriya pritir labho jivete yavata jivasya tatvajigasa nartoyas cheha karma bihi. Life's desires should never be directed towards sense gratification. One should desire only a healthy life or self-preservation. Since a human being is meant for inquiry about the absolute truth, nothing else should be the goal of one's work. So I'm going to read the English of those three again. The occupational activities a man performs according to his own position are only so much useless labor if they do not provoke attraction for the message of the personality of Godhead. All occupational engagements are certainly meant for ultimate liberation. They should never be performed for material gain. Furthermore, according to sages, one who is engaged in the ultimate occupational service should never use material gain to cultivate sense gratification. Life's desires should never be directed towards sense gratification. One should desire only a healthy life or self-preservation. Since a human being is meant for inquiry about the absolute truth, nothing else should be the goal of one's work. So, these three verses are about the kind of attitude we should have toward our life, our work, and our stay here in the material world. Generally speaking, people cherish in their heart some idea of material grandeur, that one day we will be very wealthy, one day we will be very powerful and important, one day we will see many things, we will go many places. People will hear of us. People will celebrate our family. But these are all completely unnecessary things. We've been discussing that everyone, according to their karma, has a certain destiny to achieve material prosperity. And we cannot really increase that. In one sense, you can. If you perform very difficult and long-term punya karma, various kinds of auspicious activities, then you can increase your good karma. And, you know, some people do that. They do that because they're convinced that that's really what life's about. Life is about developing a material mansion. Life is about developing a material, expanded kingdom. But we see that no matter what you have, you can always think of bigger dreams. No matter what you achieve, you can always imagine bigger achievements. And there was one American author, I don't remember his name right off the top of my head now, who once made the interesting statement that there are two great tragedies in life. And one of those great tragedies is not getting what you desperately want in life. And strangely enough, the other tragedy is getting what you want in life. So either way, if you're looking at life from material glasses, then you will definitely wind up miserable. Whether you do get what you want or whether you don't get what you want. Either way, life never satisfies us on a material level. It's just not possible. So that's why this verse is there, you know, this verse about life's desires should never be aimed at sense gratification. And occupational duty should never be performed for fruit of gain. And then that fruit of gain should never be employed for sense gratification. All occupational engagements are certainly meant for ultimate liberation. They should never be performed for material gain. Furthermore, according to sages, one who is engaged in the ultimate occupation should never use material gain to cultivate sense gratification. Life's desire should never be directed towards sense gratification. One should desire only a healthy life or self-preservation. Since a human being is meant for inquiry about the absolute truth, nothing else should be the goal of one's work. So, the problem is that somehow or other, we are living in a culture which praises very strongly and puts in the very center of everything a totally materialistic conception of what life is and what a normal and sane person should do with their lives. You know, our whole culture is screaming at us that we need to develop material prosperity. And then with that material prosperity, what will we do with it? Well, we will live our dream. Usually that's the way that it's described. You have your dream, and you can live your dream to the fullest. What's hidden in that explanation is what they really mean, is that you have your material dream, and you need matter to make your material dream happen. And to have the matter to make your material dream happen, you need money. And to need money, you need to work like an ass. And so all over our culture is screaming that at us. At every road sign that we see on the highway, we see advertisements for how you can develop your economic base. You can become more wealthy, you can have more, and with that more, you can live your, again, dream. And of course, they never talk about it because it's just assumed that living your dream, making the material world eventually fit into your dream, making the material world and your dream coincide, that will make you happy. But we see that, in fact, that doesn't necessarily work. In fact, it usually doesn't work. First of all, oftentimes you can't make the material world fit your dream. The material world refuses to cooperate with you. Other times, when it does cooperate, then we just find that we want to move on. just as kind of an interesting case, there was a famous rock band, and their name was Pink Floyd. And all for many years, they had all kinds of albums, and they were kind of an underground band. You know, when we were kids, you know, we knew who they were, but most people had no idea who they were. And they wanted to become mainstream. They wanted to have a big hit record. And then finally, that record happened when they produced this album called Dark Side of the Moon. They went from being kind of underground and known by a few, you know, esoteric followers of high rock culture to being known basically all over the world, and they became very popular. And I read that the band members, when that happened, you know, they had always had this dream that one day they would be a very, you know, popular, very well-known band. And one day it happened. And then suddenly they realized, where do we go from here? They had to come up with another dream because their dream was there. You know, they had kind of gotten to the top of the mountain. They looked around and, okay, now we're at the top of the mountain. What do we do next? And so this is what we mean, that most times, you know, there for every one Pink Floyd, there's probably, I don't know, somewhere between, I would guess, 1,000 and 10,000 bands who never amount to anything, that, you know, never get any kind of popularity, never get any kind of money, and just kind of fizzle out with only, you know, a few hundred people in a local radius knowing that they ever existed. But when they do, when somebody does make it to the top of the stack, then immediately they discover that what they were hoping for is not really a goal that is satisfying. They feel satisfied if they reach the goal. But now the next issue is, what do we do? This is not a permanent goal. It's something that I did once, and now where do I go from here? So material life, no matter what you do, no matter how much you have, will never fulfill your heart. It may fulfill your mind in as much as you have a material goal and then you achieve your material goal. You will see that you will never be actually satisfied. And we can see all along the line, if we look through history, great, powerful, famous, important, wealthy people, they have also had their difficulties. Nobody in the material world has a life where everything is nice, everything lines up the way we wish it would. And that's because nobody has perfect karma. It's not possible in the material world. And material happiness is such a fleeting, flickering thing that even if you have it in your hand, like a hummingbird, it flies away right away. It never stays. You can't capture it. You can only catch it for a few minutes, and then it moves on, and you move on. And then you think, I wish I could go there again. And then sometime later, the hummingbird comes back, and then again it disappears again. So the material world never gives us permanent material happiness. It's just not possible. The material world's not designed to do that. The material world's designed to cooperate to some extent with our material desires, but it also watches what we do. So the material world is noticing how we act and playing back the things that we do in the form of our karma. So if we want to increase our good karma, we cannot do it just by hard work. All we're doing is just hastening the good karma that was going to come to us anyways. So all our good work, our hard work, does not increase our good karma. All it does is make our good karma come quicker. And then at some point, So we've got and used up all our good karma, and what's left? Just a whole, you know, big period of time where all of our not-so-good karma comes out. So again, if you want to increase your good karma, that you can do that, but you have to do that through Vedic processes. And the devotees never recommend that solution. That's called Pravarti Marg. So Pravarti Marg is the lower path of spiritual realization, where people perform Vedic activities with the idea that they will later enjoy as a result of performing pious activities. But the Vedas are also full of stories about people who perform pious activity, and at the same time they made a mistake or they failed to do some little bit of the pious activity properly, and as a result they also had to suffer some, you know, unfortunate thing. We see that, you know, our own story that we've been talking about yesterday with the birth of Lord Ramachandra. King Dasarath was a very pious king. And he was doing many wonderful things. And citizens loved him. But he was getting on in years. But we see that his life wasn't perfect. He couldn't have children. He had 350 wives. Three of them were prominent, but he couldn't beget any children. So even in such a life, there is some drawback. Nobody gets away with a life where everything turns out like a fairy tale. Real life means that even if you have material opulence, that you also have great material suffering that goes along with that opulence. We see that later, after Dasarath performed the Ashwamedha Yajna and children were born to him, he was notified that those children weren't even ordinary children. They were direct expansions of the Supreme Lord. Even still, it wasn't like good karma sailing home, you know, in a life of happiness. Immediately we find that the story goes on that he has to exile Ram to the forest. So even in a life like Dasarath, immediately there is great tragedy. And Dasarath did not die a happy man. So what is it? Will happiness come to us as a result of material opulence? That's what everyone tells us. That's what the television tells us. That's what the billboards tell us. That's what Madison Avenue marketing tells us. That we will be happy by material opulence. In fact, there is no other way to be happy other than material opulence. So the more opulent you are, the more happy you should be. Then why is it that sometimes millionaires commit suicide? Why would that ever happen if it's true? Shows that sometimes you can be in the middle of great wealth and even in the middle of great fame and still be miserable. How is it possible? Well, to many people it's a great mystery, but not to people who read Bhagavatam. We learn that material opulence is not the real source of wealth. And it can be like a hangman's chain or a hangman's noose. If you have material opulence and you do not use it properly, you will hang yourself faster than someone who is poor and unable to have any kind of opulence. Because material opulence affords you all the tools you need to go to heaven and to go to hell in a rocket ship. So you can go there very fast. The more opulence you have, the quicker you can make it to the bottom of the pit of hell. And usually people do that with material opulence. You just have to look at the stories of people who win the lottery and how they win, you know, $84 million, $164 million. You know, money that we can't even conceive of how big that amount of money is. And we find a few years later they're bankrupt. How is that possible? Because through great wealth, one has great temptations. And if you are not ready for those great temptations, then wealth will be the source of your rapid decline. One American president, Abraham Lincoln, once said that most men can survive and make it through very difficult times. But if you really want to test the character of a man, give him power or wealth. Because under those circumstances, then you have to have great restraint, not great opulence or great power means that you have to know when and how to use it and when not to use it. If you simply indulge yourself in your great power, you will become more or less a mini Robin Hood. That's what invariably happens to people who have great power and great wealth. They become mini Ravanas, you know. Ravana had everything. He had taken over the treasury of the demigod by conquering Kuvera. He had a celestial airship he could fly around in. Ravana had many women, some of which came to him willingly, and others he kidnapped from various places. He had, nobody could tell him what to do, nobody could tell him where to go. People were afraid of him. The demigods trembled when his name was mentioned. He could fight with anybody and not worry that he would lose. But we see that he was not at all satisfied. He was constantly looking for something. So if someone like Ravana can't be satisfied, then how will anybody be satisfied with opulence? Because Ravana was certainly in a more opulent position than any of our modern millionaires or any of our modern political leaders. He was physically strong, besides being politically strong, and he could do anything. But he still wanted things that he couldn't have. In fact, that becomes the one thing that becomes the main driving force in the life of someone who has great opulence, is getting things that for some reason you shouldn't or can't have. Which always means crossing the line somewhere in some book. So that's why people with great opulence bring themselves to ruin very quickly. Ravan did it by taking what he couldn't have and shouldn't have, which was Sita, the consort of Ram. Sita did not want to go to him. He had already many queens. He didn't need any more. But she represented something that he couldn't have or shouldn't have. And somehow or other, when a materialistic person is put in a circumstance where he becomes aware that there is something that he shouldn't have or couldn't have, immediately that becomes the driving force in his life, to have that thing that he shouldn't have or couldn't have. Because he has so many things, why shouldn't I have this too? And on top of it, he has resources to try to figure out how to get that thing. So Ravana felt that he had resources, he had his strength, he had his intelligence. Now let's look at it from the other perspective. We talked about people who have great opulence and still are not satisfied and still want more. Let's look at it from the perspective of people who have very little opulence but constantly want more and can't get it. And of course that's our mantra, you know, in the story of Ram. You see that she was an apsara, and she was actually sent by the demigods to cause the situation to come to a head much faster, and she was very successful at that. So when Ram was put forward to be coronated by Dasarath, of course, we discussed this last night, that Dasarath had several very bad dreams, and his astrologers told him that in his chart there was definitely some kind of ominous situation that would happen very soon. And so he thought, well, maybe that ominous situation is that I will die. So I better crown Ram right now rather than wait. Because if I wait, who knows, maybe I'll be dead and I won't be able to crown him. So everybody had expected that Ram would be crowned. It wasn't a surprise to anybody. He was the eldest son from all kinds of angles of vision. It was obvious Ram should be crowned. He was obviously the most capable. He was obviously the most loved. And it was predicted that he would be the king. All these things were there. So, of course, that Dasarath just sped up the arrangement, made it more immediate. Was not surprising in itself. Maybe the suddenness was a little surprising. And people in the village or in the city of Ayodhya, they didn't know why Dasarath had decided to expedite the crowning of Ramachandra. But of course it was because he'd seen these bad omens, and his astrologers and ministers had cautioned him that there might be some disturbance. So when he found out about it, he decided to crown Ram immediately. And they waited for the next available auspicious time. And there was no time to send a message to Bharat and Shatrughna, who were visiting Kushadvaja. And nobody thought anything about that anyways. However, Mantara was able to cue into that. And she saw it as foul play. That somehow or other, Dasarath wanted to push Bharat out of the picture. That's how she read it. So we can see that circumstances can be ambivalent. We can look at a circumstance and one person can read something into that circumstance, and another person would not necessarily read that into the circumstance. And, you know, we can put two and two together and come up with five. Evidently, that's what Mantara did. She saw that this was not accidental, that, you know, Ram was being crowned while Bharat was away. She thought this was purposeful. This was part of a plan. And this was part of a system that would gradually minimalize or marginalize Bharat. Maybe even do away with them altogether. And she brought these concerns to Kaikeyi. And Kaikeyi, of course, was at first not at all taken by this kind of logic and reasoning. But Mantara played on her insecurities. So insecurity is a key factor here. One thing that helps people to deal with the concept of security in the material world is just try to grasp the idea that there is no such thing as security in the material world. There never was, there never will be, and not just for one person, but for every person. Whether you have nothing or whether you're the king, it does not matter. There is no such thing as security. No one knows when they will die. No one knows what will happen next. And sometimes completely unexpected things take place. So if you're worried about security, you shouldn't be worried any longer. Just realize you're worried about something that doesn't exist, like eggs from a horse or a flower in the sky. It's something that doesn't exist.
But we pay for it, man.
Was that? So well, we pay for it, right, right. You, we get the insurance and you pay it off. And you think the insurance will pay for it. Well, what happened in Katrina? Did the insurance pay out? People had paid all kinds of money for insuring their homes and properties. But when hurricane came and wiped out New Orleans, many of the you know, insurance companies went bankrupt or refused to pay or called it an act of God and started litigations and so, you know. So, anyway, we see that in the material world, there is no such thing as security. Yet, we still take precautions, we do these things. In one sense, that's not wrong, but the basic fact to keep in mind is that don't stress over it too much because it doesn't exist. That at any moment, the world can suddenly turn in an unexpected way. And if it turns in an unexpected way, that means you also cannot be prepared for the way that it turns because you didn't expect it and probably no one else did either. The world can suddenly change in a drastic way. And our modern world is very tenuous. It can be disturbed in a massive way very easily. Our society is very artificial. The way we eat, the way we get our food, the way we work with one another is all dependent on a very delicate house of cards, a very delicate, very complex inner structure of technology and modern ingenuity of logistics that have been thought out and carefully planned. And it's very easy that that house of cards can go down even very quickly. And suddenly our world looks very different. Very different. So the economy could be the source of our new downturn. It could be some political event that could be the source of our new downturn. Or it could be some natural catastrophe that could be the source of our downturn. And we've seen that all these things are been hinted at in the past few years. We've seen natural disasters that have really laid low whole sections of even a modern, scientifically progressive, technologically advanced country like America, what to speak of other less developed countries, that there have been, you know, natural disasters that have wiped out sections. We see that the economy is by no means stable. And there's talk of making the U.S. dollar no longer the national currency. If that comes to pass, then we'll see a depression that nobody has is ready for. And it likely will come to pass. How soon is another question. Then we see that in the idea of political events are always coming and going. And whenever there is any kind of disturbance, the politicians take advantage of it and try to push it in some direction. But we don't have politicians like Ram or even Dasarath. We have politicians who are very insecure. And so because they're very insecure, and they are completely dependent on material arrangements, material opulence, and technology. That's the only thing they know. Whatever crisis comes, our politicians will respond to it, without a doubt, by using material resources, technology, and some kind of, material arrangement. They will never respond in any other kind of way. And this will certainly fail. So our world is in a very, you know, tedious or very, it's tottering like a drop of water on a lotus leaf. At any minute it can fall. So we understand that we have no security. Our security has to come from another place, and that is by connecting with the Supreme. We know if we connect with the Supreme, the floodgates may open, things may change, the chessboard may rearrange itself drastically. But if we are connected to the Supreme, we will feel that somehow or other, Krishna will help us, at least to understand that we are living through our own destiny. If someone is living according to the law of karma, then that person is living the mirror reflection of what they have done for so many selfish and adharmic things they've done, they will suffer. And for so many unselfish, altruistic, and pious things that they've done, they will suffer, they will enjoy. So these two things are simply mirrored in their future. That's all. But for people who have become involved in following the Supreme Lord, then the Supreme Lord actually is engineering your destiny. And that destiny is there to help you make spiritual progress. And we don't know what the Supreme Lord has in mind for us. We don't have any ability to see the future of what the Supreme Lord has in mind for us. And that's what makes it interesting. However, if someone has faith in the Supreme Lord, then they know that whatever does come is actually meant for our purification. It is for our best. We don't have to worry that we will be somehow or other destroyed. If we're destroyed, the body certainly is going to be destroyed anyway. We know this body will not last forever. So it may come today, it may come in 100 years, we don't know when it will come, but some way or another the body will be destroyed. However, the soul cannot be destroyed no matter what happens. But what is important is the consciousness of the soul. What is our consciousness? Are we thinking about material gain? Are we thinking about actually becoming purified? If we're thinking about being purified, then certainly we will either go back to the spiritual world or we will be in a position where we will be in a better circumstance in the material world to launch ourselves into the spiritual world the next time around. So, security and insecurity are mostly the preoccupation of people who are very materialistically oriented, because for them material happiness is everything. And for people who are materialistically oriented, for them the world has to be a certain way. We have a certain recipe for the material world, and the world has to look like that recipe. And the more detailed your recipe is for how the material world should look, the more you will suffer in the future, because the odds are that the material world will not wind up the way that your recipe wants it to wind up. So the more details you have about the way you hope the world will be in the future, the more chances are that the world will not wind up looking like that, and you will be miserable as a result. However, if you recognize that the world is not up to us, the world is in Krishna's hands, and the world is there to help us to become purified, to go back home, back to Godhead, then you know, maybe I will have more, maybe I will have less. But more likely, what always happens is we have more for a while, we have less for a while, we have more for a while, we have less for a while. And we see that some people have way more than we have, and some people have way less than we have. And if we are able to grasp that, then we don't worry that I can go from this level to that level and spend our precious human energy just trying to become more wealthy, more influential than someone we have in our mind. So Kaikei had her insecurities piqued by Mantara. She thought, maybe I'm not as important to Dasarath as I thought I was. She actually felt that she was the most important queen because she was the youngest and the most attractive. Kaushalya actually felt marginalized. But now, with the idea that Ram would become the next king, now it appears Mantara has put the fear in her mind that what if now Kaushalya becomes the main queen and Kaikeyi becomes marginalized? You wouldn't like that, would you? So she becomes fearful now that maybe her position will be changed. The one thing about positions is they always change. You know, the material world never lets anything stay the same way. Generally, the nature of the material world is change. One thing comes, another goes. A person becomes a president, and then 4 years later he goes for re-election. Maybe he becomes president again. But at any rate, after 8 years, he's out. Somebody else becomes president. Somebody becomes the most wealthy person in the news this week. Later on, somebody else becomes the most wealthy person. Someone becomes the best basketball or football player, and then a few years later, somebody else becomes the most important basketball or football player. Nothing ever stays, because the material world is constantly changing. And it always feels very inebriating, even very, you know, amazing to be on the upswing when you're coming into the limelight, being suddenly taken out of being unknown to becoming very popular, very famous, very powerful. But then what about the other way? Because the tide will always take you past the top of the hill to the other side, where you are now being phased out, where now somebody else is coming in, where you're now not any longer the focus of anything. Somebody else is the focus. And this is the part that people are not ready for, because people identify with the material world, they identify with material happiness, and material happiness is all about opulence, arrangements, and material dreams, and making that dream a reality in the material world. But that's a perfect prescription for misery. And instead, our consciousness should be focused on how can we please the Supreme? Because if we're thinking about how to please Krishna, maybe today we have abundant opulence with which to do something for Krishna. Maybe tomorrow our opulence to do something for Krishna is reduced. But either way, we use what we have for Krishna. We may have a lot, we may have a little. And if we have a lot, we use a lot for Krishna. If we have a little, we use a little for Krishna. And we are not disturbed by that. But someone who's using their opulence for themselves, if we have a lot, then I can enjoy a lot. If I have not so much, then I can't enjoy. It's a very different way of looking at things. So understand that the purpose of human life is self-realization, as it says, you know. A human being is meant for inquiry after the absolute truth. Nothing else should be the goal of one's work. And there will always be a little mantra in our heads somewhere that will tell us, what if your position is minimized? What if you become less opulent? What if something happens? You should take some materialistic plan, and you should do it right now. It can't wait. This materialistic plan has to go into effect right now if it's going to be successful. And because people listen to that little, you know, inner mantra, they live their lives constantly in this insecure fear that maybe my opulence will diminish, maybe my position will be diminished, maybe someone else will come into the limelight, maybe someone else will do something, so I should take action right now. And what action should I take? Some drastic and difficult action. And when we make our effort to take this drastic and difficult action, then we use our human energy, our time, in a way that is totally wasteful and often harmful to other people. And so there we have to bear the karma that comes back from that. So what does it really matter if someone has more money? What does it really matter if someone's more powerful? What does it really matter if someone's more good-looking or more famous? These are the things that people usually stress over. Someone else has more money than I have. Someone else is more intelligent than I am. Someone else is more attractive than I am. Someone else is more famous than I am. Someone else has had more experiences than I have. But in the end, each person is different. Why do we need to compare ourselves? Why do we have to feel that if someone else rises to prominence and I don't, why does that upset me? We can always do the best we can. And we know that if we are pleasing Krishna, maybe it pleases Krishna to put us in the center light, in the spotlight. And maybe it doesn't please Krishna to put us in the center light. Maybe it pleases Krishna for us to have a lot of opulence to use in his service. Maybe right now we're not ready for that, and Krishna doesn't want to put us in a position where we have a lot of opulence to use in his service. But if we continue to serve and we don't watch the stock market of material happiness, then we will advance, we will become purified, and Krishna will be able to more and more use us as a tool for bringing his desire into the world, not our own material dream. We are trying to live Krishna's dream, and we are trying to know what Krishna's dream is. And we learn Krishna's dream by trying to mold ourselves to understand the small things that Krishna wants us to do. We do the small things that Krishna is asking us to do, we will find that we will be easily able to live Krishna's bigger dream. And he will reveal what it is as we go on. So, I'll just end again with reiterating our verses. All occupational engagements are certainly meant for ultimate liberation. They should never be performed for material gain. Furthermore, according to sages, one who is engaged in ultimate occupational service should never use material gain to cultivate sense gratification. Life's desire should never be directed towards sense gratification. One should desire only a healthy life or self-preservation. Since a human being is meant for inquiry about the absolute truth, nothing else should be the goal of one's work. And the very first verse was, the occupational activities a man performs according to his own position are only so much useless labor if they do not provoke attraction for the message of the personality of Godhead. So if we're performing our occupational duties and we're not becoming gradually more attracted to Krishna, that means that we're not performing those occupational duties to serve Krishna. If we were, we would be becoming more attracted to Krishna. If we're becoming more attracted to our opulence that we're getting from our occupational remuneration, then that means that we're phasing Krishna out and we're phasing material desire in. So this is a good barometer to understand. Are we becoming more attracted to Krishna, or are we becoming more aware that we don't have time for Krishna, that we have to put Krishna in the background, that right now we have an important material project that needs us to downclass Krishna's involvement in our life so that we can make that material project possible? So these are always questions we should ask ourselves. And I'll stop there. If there's questions, we can discuss. Yeah.
How should we cultivate that becoming fearless, and how can we always focus in serving Lord?
Well, the process of devotional service is in itself very purifying, and is also very liberating from fear and from suffering. In the Madhuri Kadambani, it mentions that devotional service is klesha, gni, and subhada. So, klesha gni means what? Somebody tell me.
Klesha is suffering?
Yeah.
Material distress.
It destroys suffering. Klesha means it destroys suffering. And Subhada means what?
Auspiciousness.
Yeah, it gives, it da, it gives Subha, or auspiciousness. It gives auspiciousness, and it destroys suffering. So if devotional service is done properly, it gives auspiciousness, and it destroys suffering. It also destroys fear. And so we learn that trying to follow the sadhana, in the beginning, devotional service does not come natural for us, although in fact it is natural for the soul. It doesn't come natural because we have lived many unnatural lifetimes of unnaturally following material dreams, and now we are very habituated to following unnatural material dreams. And so naturally, whenever we see our material dream threatened, we feel very, very fearful. In fact, sometimes we feel more fear when our material dream is threatened than even when our own life is threatened. There have been lots of instances of people risking their lives to try to make sure their material dream is not destroyed. So as you begin to realize your material dream is just that, it's just a dream. It's not as important as we have been taught to believe by our whole society. As we find that out, then fear also diminishes because we realize that we can still live in so many different circumstances. It can be like this, it can be like that. Only when you become crystallized, when you become frozen in a particular vision of a particular material dream, do you become brittle and very fearful of everything. Because so many things can happen to upset things exactly the way you want them to be. But when you're actually just serving Krishna, you know that things may change. And today I may do things in one way, and tomorrow I may be doing things in a different way. But everything is still the same. I am still serving Krishna, maybe in a different circumstance, maybe under different conditions, but I'm still serving. So in this way, we are less prone for that fear. And as we become more devotionally inclined, we begin to get realization that we're not this body, and then the primal fear of dying becomes also less, prominent in our minds. So these things are a part of the daily practice of devotional service. The more we try to make Krishna part of our daily lives, we try to give Krishna to others, we chant japa, we chant our rounds, and we try to hear them, the more we perform devotional service of all various kinds, the more we begin to feel like our lives really do revolve around Krishna, because in fact they do. Our consciousness will be molded by our actions, and also our actions are molded by our consciousness. Both things work. So we employ both techniques to focus our lives on Krishna. We try to act for Krishna, even though it might seem a little artificial. And by doing that, then we focus our mind on Krishna. And because our mind is focused on Krishna, now we want to act for Krishna more. And in that way, we gradually become more and more focused on Krishna. And when someone is very focused on Krishna, there's no illusion, there's no lamentation. Such a person understands, yes, I will die. And yes, there is no such thing as material security. The material world will always change. And however it changes, I will just adapt to whatever new changes are, and I will still be doing the same thing, some kind of devotional service. It may be under different circumstances, it may be in a different location or whatever, but I'll still be doing devotional service. Does that make sense? Yes?
Maharaj, how can we direct our activities, like working or doing job, or many material endeavors, into serving Krishna?
Well, that's a very manifold question. One of the things is if you're using the fruit That's what how Prabhupada put it. If you're using the fruit of your occupational activities to serve Krishna, then essentially it's devotional service, even whatever it is. Of course, we shouldn't be engaged in occupation that directly is contrary to the regular principles. Having said that, the most important thing is that if we're using the fruit of our activities for Krishna, then essentially the activity that we do in occupational service can be counted as devotional service. So, Jayananda drove a cab. Generally, we don't think of driving a cab as being devotional service. But he gave the money to Prabhupada. So his driving a cab was devotional service. Devotees can work in factories, although I certainly don't recommend it, having done it myself at one point. And if you give the money to Krishna, then that's devotional service. Of course, what you do, as we hear here, one should require only a healthy life or self-preservation. Kamasya nendriya prithir labho jivetiyavata jivasya tatva jivasya narto yas cheha karma bihi. That life's desire should never be aimed at sense gratification. One should desire only a healthy life. So in other words, we can understand that we don't have to live under a tree, naked, or in a cave, or any of that kind of thing. But at the same time, we should not artificially expand our material understanding of what we need to a lot of extravagant and difficult things that then begin to eat up our time. Because the more we imagine that we need for our material necessities to be nicely fulfilled, then the more struggle we do to make that basic, level possible. So understand that the more you can do without, the more free you will be in your ability to give time to Krishna, your ability to give your life to Krishna. And of course, everybody has to come and make those kind of occupational decisions. Will I use my occupation directly to give people Krishna and to keep myself Krishna conscious? Or instead, will I just have an occupation and then I will use what I get, the money that comes from that occupation, to serve Krishna? It's two different ways of living. And some people can do one and some can do the other. It's not necessarily that one is good and the other one's bad. But if you are using your occupation not to directly serve Krishna or not to directly preach about Krishna, if that's not possible or not practical, then you should not overly engage your time in such an occupation so you have no time for using whatever money you have, no time for listening to Krishna's katha, no time for becoming spiritually part of a group that goes out to try to minister to others. Because to really become focused on Krishna, the best way is to try to give Krishna to others. So if you are ingenious, if you have an understanding of how people think and how they work, then you could do it yourself. If not, then align yourself with people who are already doing it, help them, and try to do the same thing that they're doing. Because giving Krishna to others is the fastest way to reorient your whole life around Krishna. And your occupation, it should either be used directly to preach about Krishna, but in many cases that's not possible. So if it's not possible, then don't overly encumber yourself with an occupation that eats 95% of your time, and so you've got a measly 5% of your time left, and usually you're just too physically wasted to do anything with that 5%, and you use it to recuperate so you can go back into the occupation. So if your occupation is not directly, you're not able to minister, then make sure that that occupation is down. It doesn't eat a huge amount of your time. So there is a room in your life for another life where you are preaching, another life where you're taking the fruits of your occupation and using them to help others to become Krishna conscious. Yes,
Maharaji, you have given a lot to digest here. But I mean, I'll try to be as delicate as I can in this question.
Mm-hmm.
The messaging which I see most of the time is towards inaction.
The method?
The messaging is mostly towards inaction.
What's towards inaction
in a sense.
The messaging?
Yeah, I mean, it's the extract which, again, which I'm collecting. So, I mean,
I see.
In the sense, you should not pursue endeavors which are a little bit harder. You know, try to stay in your comfy, cozy environment so that you don't involve yourself too much, where your energies are concentrated too much, you know, at achieving those tasks. When Prabhupada came to the States,
mm-hmm.
that was a monumental task.
Yeah.
And of course, his Guru Maharaj had given him, just go to the West. And at the age of 70, he took that task, although it was a spiritual task to come and give us this Krishna consciousness. But he took it anyways.
Mm.
And nobody can repeat that again in this world, at least now.
Mm.
Does it not apply to us in our material life? Because we are here.
Mm.
We are living in this Kali Yuga. We are not living in Dwapara Yuga or Satya Yuga or any other Yuga.
Right.
We are bound by the surroundings around us.
Right.
So, finding that fine balance,
mm-hmm.
one must struggle for. And that's where my question is revolving.
Because
yesterday I overheard you, I think you were telling that the girl who is interested
right.
in Krishna
right.
consciousness, she's starting her life, and I heard kind of, grades matter, but grades don't matter. So that kind of makes...
You heard it what?
The grades matter, but they don't matter that much.
Grades matter, okay.
Right?
Okay.
So,
right.
It's a mixed message.
It's a mixed message, right. This is what I'm saying, is that it's all important, your attitude. You can work like anything, night and day, if you're fully working for Krishna. But you have to be fully working for Krishna. Otherwise, if you're working night and day and 80% of it is for material advancement and 20% is Krishna, you'll just burn out. You know, that's a very different thing. And most of us are somewhere in between, you know, that we're working some for Krishna and some for various things. Whenever we're doing something that's directly for Krishna, you know, like helping with a Rath Yatra, developing a temple, organizing programs, those kind of things. Those kind of things, there's no limit to how much enthusiastic or how much effort we can put into those things, because we're obviously doing them for Krishna. We gain nothing from those activities. Those are directly, you know, to serve Krishna. However, she's going to try to come in there. If we're using that same intensity, and we're not really clear whether we're doing it for Krishna or not, and, you know, we haven't made a very strong orientation for Krishna yet in our lives, then quite likely that intensity will not bring us closer to Krishna, but we will start to appreciate what fruits come in and use them in the wrong direction, and that will drag us further away from Krishna. So Prabhupada worked night and day. But he didn't work night and day just to make money so his family and he could prosper. He was building a movement. And we can do the same thing. There's no harm there. But it's the attitude that makes the difference. What are we doing the extreme endeavor for? We can do extreme endeavor and there's no harm there. And that's not the mode of passion, actually. Although it may look like it, you know. Usually the mode of passion is characterized by extreme endeavor. But extreme endeavor for materialistic goals, that's actually the definition for the mode of passion. Extreme endeavor for Krishna is not the mode of passion. It's utsaha. It's called enthusiasm, which is a very different thing, to an uninformed mind, the two look very similar. In fact, most people can't tell the difference between the two. And sometimes even devotees can't tell the difference between the two, because our minds can slip. You know, somebody can be doing sankirtan and think, I want to get as many books out as I possibly can. This was something that we witnessed a lot in the early days of the movement. And devotees were very, as we called it, fired up to go distribute books. But were they really trying to help people, or were they just trying to get numbers so that their name would be higher on the list? It may not be so immediately apparent, but you have to understand your motivations, why you're doing things. If your motivation genuinely is to increase Krishna's service and to help the fallen conditioned soul, then no matter how much endeavor you pour into something like that, that's going to fuel your enthusiasm for Krishna. But we should always be aware that devotional service does not start out pure. We start out with what we call karma mishra bhakti. We are doing bhakti, but we are doing it with a mixture of material motivations. So as we watch ourselves progress in devotional service, we have to catch that material motivation which may be creeping in there. Are we also not just worried about doing something big for Krishna, but we want to be a big person in the society of devotees, which is not exactly the same thing as doing something big for Krishna, you know. So these materialistic motivations can creep in there. And again, the motive passion and what we're avoiding is extreme endeavor for a materialistic aim. What are materialistic aims? To become materially happy through acquisition. To become materially well-placed by getting a big, very well-noticed position. To become very popular, that other people will come to you and think that you're very wonderful for some reason. These are the kind of things that are actually materialistic goals. If we are genuinely trying to serve Krishna, we won't be swayed by them. But it's also possible in devotional service to have admixtures of these two things going on. So in and of itself, extreme endeavor is not a wrong thing. But the motivation that pushes that extreme endeavor, that has to be analyzed. And if it's actually 100% for Krishna, then all speed ahead. If it's not, then we have to do one of two things. We have to purify it, or we maybe have to slow it down enough, because otherwise, if we just burn out, and that's what material endeavor always brings you to, is the stage of burnout. The more you run after the material carrot, the easier it is to burn out, because eventually you have to burn out. Material desires can't keep pace with the material body or the material circumstance. We cash in all our chips at some point, and we fall from the mode of passion into the mode of ignorance. So that's why, you know, either one has to reduce the material endeavor so that one can get a hold on where we're doing and what we're doing, or one has to purify. You know, it's better, of course, to purify that activity, but if you can't purify it, or you don't have the circumstance or knowledge to know how to do that, better at least to reduce it, so then you can add Krishna into your life in a more concentrated way. And then once you learn what Krishna's about, then it's possible to start ramping things up again. Does that make sense?
Thank you,
Maharaj. Okay. Thanks a lot very much for your kind attention. All glories to the devotees of the Lord Hare Krishna.
Jai.